Hi guys, it's your host Matilda,
Hadiza,
and Imama,
and you're listening to the Africa Calypso podcast.
Very, very, very excited that the pod is back. I've been listening diligently.
Hey, really?
I'm loving it.
The episodes are
rolling in. The audience is growing and re-engaging. So it's really lovely to see. You're always crushing it. So I've always been a big fan.
Oh, thank you. We still call you our Oga.
We did. Always happy to support.
Thank you. And we're happy to have you on. I personally want to hear the story, but then I was like, actually, I think this would be an exciting topic for everyone to actually get an insight on. So, yeah. Wait, the initial reason you had gone to Nigeria was to write your book?
Man, my sister, we don't work out. We don't work out, come back. So I've been working on this novel almost three years and some.
Nice.
So I was in Jamaica last year.
Yeah,
I was in Jamaica. I was in this place called I was in Kingston. Not this place, but everybody probably knows it.
Like Ontario?
Kingston,
no,
Jamaica.
Wow.
I guess everybody does not know this place. Kingston was wild. You pull up in Kingston, you land in Kingston, and you go to the airport, and it basically looks like Murtala Mohammed Airport.
And then
they start speaking, and they're all speaking in their accent and their patois and their Creole. So you're like, oh, I thought I was in Lagos, but no. And main downtown Kingston basically looks like Jerry Keja. But it's like if Lagos and like Johannesburg were put together, because they drive on the other side of the road.
Oh.
And so that's how they drive in Johannesburg as well. The point is...
The British still have their hand on them.
On everything. So the point is, yeah, so I was writing my novel. So I spent some time in Kingston. I wrote a chunk of it there. I got very close to the end. And then when I went back to Nigeria, I had another retreat where I finished the last piece. So the book is done.
Oh, congratulations!
Yeah, thank you. And it was really interesting because... I mean, you know things by like the memory of a family or the memory of the family memory, right? What you've heard passed down, the stories that you tell. And I'm drawing on some of those stories to shape the core narrative of my novel. But then it's different when you actually go to the place.
Yeah.
And you're taking the smells and the textures and you see the color of the grass and the goats on the road. And
so what is this novel about?
I don't give too much away just yet, but it's setting a Nigerian boarding school.
Okay.
And there's a lot of magic involved.
Ooh. Yeah,
magic, it's giving like Harry Potter, but...
Harry Potter. It's more so like Lord of the Flies.
Okay.
Oh, interesting.
Lord of the Flies, but very Nigerian, very boarding school, set in 2004.
Oh,
a lot of Yoruba magic, a lot of Igbo magic, a lot of masquerade.
I could absolutely see Lord of the Flies happening in Nigerian boarding schools. Like,
yeah.
It just makes sense.
Yeah, so the book is about this curse takes over this school and the boys are trying to break the curse. And it's inspired by the Sosoliso plane crash and the Dana plane crash because I lost my cousin and my auntie in the Dana plane crash.
So
the kind of the core idea of the book is, you know, what if we could stop that plane from crashing? And what if those kids who went on that Sosoliso flight, or everybody who went on that flight, what if we could stop that flight from crashing? So I kind of work it back from that question. Yeah, and I'm exploring just themes of boyhood and grief and, yeah, like when do boys break, you know, and how do we try to build ourselves and what pieces do we leave behind? So, yeah, so I've been working on that book now almost 3.5 years. I've started my next book. Yeah, being in the village and kind of being in the place where the magic lives was such a special experience.
Oh, wow.
That is so cool.
What have you been up to?
Not the silence.
Well, you know, I live in big lives now.
Problem is that you started with this, I went to Jamaica and then I went to the village and, like, you know, I touched the grass and the magic. Guy, I've been in this Canada.
I was screaming.
There's been no magic. I mean, apart from my 9-to-5, So it's hard to follow that. That's what we're trying to say.
Nah, we also used to romanticize the village. Nah, man, that place is tough as well. So
no, we want to hear all about it. And honestly, that's what this episode is about. But I guess we can go into like what's been up in the last week for us. So have you guys' weeks been just the past week or two? Have you guys been keeping up with your resolutions?
What was my resolution like?
Imam, I already know that you didn't keep up.
How do you know? How do you know?
You said you were going to do things embarrassed, but okay, then I already knew.
Embarrassed? No, I have done some things embarrassed. I have shy. Okay. Yes. Now, did I follow through on everything? No, but did I start? Yes.
Fair enough.
Exactly. So yeah, I think that was actually my main resolution. I think that was the main thing I said. I think the other like small things I had written off myself, which yeah, I think honestly for the most part, I would say that I've been kind of keeping up with my resolutions. Yeah.
Can you share what they were? Or did I miss it?
So I mean like my main resolution was just to just do things embarrassed. So like I have this thing where I'm always like, oh my gosh, embarrassment can kill me. Like literally if I get embarrassed, I'll fall and I'll die. Like it's like I'm very, I don't say die, I say faint because die is quite extreme.
But you cannot die in Jesus' name.
Exactly, yeah, I can't die in Jesus' name. Exactly, there is power in the tongue. So a lot of times, I guess I would find that embarrassment would hold me back from doing a bunch of things. And this year, one of my resolution, like my main resolution was actually to do things embarrassed. So like even if I was shy and even if I thought that I might faint, do it anyways. And I think I have done like a couple things embarrassed so far. Like things that like typically I'll be like, oh my gosh. For instance, okay, you know, I'm just going to open my ass in public. So gosh, I'm even so shy.
Do it embarrassed. This is manifesting, yeah.
Exactly. Hey, God save me. Okay, so literally, it's like, I would never, like, message a guy first because, like, when I say, like, message a guy first, I mean, like, shoot my shots because, like, I'm like, oh my gosh, if he doesn't respond, I can faint. But I did it, right? Like, it's like, I shot my shots-ish. I messaged the guy first and I'm still alive and well. So I think that's, like, step one. In doing things a bit embarrassed this year. And I'm sure there's going to be like other things. I mean, not just in like relationship life, like even in like career and like a bunch of other things. So yeah, that's typically the gist of it.
Good luck. We're rooting for you, man.
Hey. Thank you. Thank you.
How about you, Deezer?
I've been actually been sick. So.
Oh, no.
Oh yeah. I heard you coughing a bit.
Yeah. I was really sick last week. So 2 weeks out of the year already. I just spent, you know, in my bed. But I mean, I'm pretty grateful. I mean, it's been good so far. Thank God. I have no issues. In terms of my New Year's resolution, I mean, I've kind of been obsessing over it. This is kind of going
is
to
this
be
your
deep.
Hair growth thing?
Yeah, it's the hair growth thing, right?
Did so you say it's going to be deep?
This, yeah, it is a bit deep. So basically, to grow hair, like as in to grow natural, like 4C, at least my 4C hair. I absolutely cannot use extensions. Like I thought of using extensions, like literally freaks me out. Like as in like actually attaching the extensions to my hair. Yeah. Cause I noticed last year, like I did grow my hair quite a bit, but I was adding the extensions to the tips of my hair, and the tips of my hair that the extensions were being added to are much thinner than the new growth that came in between last year and now. Right. So I'm like, okay, that's how I knew I couldn't use extensions at all because my hair will grow, but it will look raggedy. So now that leaves me with, it's making me confront, and I was sick and I was in my bed, so I had nothing else to do except think. It's making me confront the fact that I feel like I don't like my hair unless it looks a certain way. I don't know how to explain it, but I'm like, is that me or is that society? It's both. When I think I want to go out, I just can't go out with my hair twisted up because it just doesn't look, there's no way I can look put together with my hair twisted up. But why? It's the hair that grows out of my scalp.
Mm-hmm.
Literally. So anyways, yeah, I can go on and on, but I think that has been my greatest dilemma. It's like, I'm still going to follow through with it and stuff, but it's just been a dilemma for me. Like kind of, it's making me confront, like, do I wear, have I been wearing extensions because they were fashionable, or really I was just avoiding my actual hair anyway.
That is deep.
Was it a choice, or is it like does it feel mandatory to do that?
Yeah. Highest of keys, I don't think I've worn my hair out naturally since secondary school.
Really?
I mean, like, I've had it for like very short intervals, but not, I don't wear my hair out just for like months on end and stuff without any extensions.
Like no extensions.
Right now I have my hair itself in a ponytail, but then there's an attached extension to it still. So it's like,
And Hadiza, was that learned? Did you always feel that way? Was there a point in your life where you started feeling that way? Have you examined those thoughts?
I think, yeah. So definitely it is learned, because I grew up in a household where we actually were not allowed extensions. So in the beginning of my life, we didn't use extensions at all. So like even attachments like was not used. Like it was something that I think maybe my family noticed that, okay, you know, people, kids my age are starting to use it. Maybe she would want to use it too. And I probably would bring it up a few times and stuff. So, you know, they let me use it, but it wasn't the norm in my household. That's why I would steady braid my hair all back. And when I first came to Canada, I was doing that. I was doing the all backs. I would do like extensions, but there would be times I would go out with my hair, right? But I think after some time of being here, I just felt like I just can't do that anymore. I don't know how to explain it. There's just something inherently wrong with my hair in a way. I don't know why. So I definitely feel like it's learned. And I think also maybe as I get older, there's an expectation that, you know, I'm leaving childhood and I'm becoming like more of a woman. So I'm supposed to look more womanly.
Right.
So, but that natural hair thing, if it's not long, you know, it doesn't really give woman, it gives child. Like, I don't know how to explain, like that's just what's it. I know it's messed up, but literally this is true talks. If I'm translating my hesitation to wear my hair out into words, that's basically what it translates to. And you know, it's just trying to battle that, because I mean, you know, I step outside and everybody has straight hair and it's long, right? So it's like, if it can't be straight, it has to be long, one of the two. Or it has to look like braided, because that's also something I see more common, because, you know, Black women, we braid our hair, we wear extensions and stuff, but it has to look at least that way. But I can't wear extensions. Way. Yeah, I can't wear extensions because I've identified that it does break my hair. So I can't do that. But then I do want long hair, but then I don't have long hair. I should accept my hair the way it is now, because it will get there eventually. But then I'm struggling to accept the way it is now, basically.
Yeah.
This reminds me of that episode we did with, I think it was Sinclair. Is that Sinclair?
Yeah.
Do you guys remember? The natural hair episode, and just like, I guess the whole, not politics, but just how Black women's hair has been, it's like such like a social issue from time, and then there was the natural hair movement and like protective styles and like all those things that came up. And it, I feel like it's just really interesting the relationship Black women have with like our hair and length and thickness, and not me saying thickness, but length and thickness and curl patterns and all those things. It's quite interesting.
Yeah.
And thanks for sharing it, Tisa. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Yeah. I really appreciate that. I think we should probably go into that. Like, as you get more comfortable with wearing it out natural, we'd love to hear. So let's talk about that more as the episodes go on. The episode is going to be geared around Chuki's experience in Nigeria, but I think we could follow the journey of you writing your book right from its genesis. And from there, we can get into your experiences in Jamaica. I didn't know you went to Jamaica.
Yeah, Jamaica was a blast.
I would imagine. But also your experience in Nigeria, because I know you did your coming of age ceremony there as well. And you said it was in Imo State. I found that really interesting. Imama is from Imo State.
I'm from Imo. Yeah.
So you guys are brothers and sisters.
Benim.
We are.
Yeah. So I think Imama can also like share, you know, what she knows about her culture, and you guys can like exchange things here.
I think I'm going to be a little bit embarrassed, but I don't know too much.
We'll share what we know.
Yeah, I know we just like got into the episode, we just started talking, but I want to introduce Chuki Well, give him his accolades. He's been on our podcast before, of course, but for those that haven't listened to the previous episode that he was on, go check it out. We'll plug it in the description here. But Chuki is a writer. He's a poet, a playwright, an essayist, and he is the founder and editor of Trad Magazine. And Trad generally, because Trad isn't just the magazine, right, Chuki?
Exactly.
Yeah, it goes beyond that. So he's a man of many words, I would say. Many experiences too. I feel like you're living one of the lives I would love to live. So when I hear your stories, I'm really, really interested in them and drawing from them and living vicariously through you. So I want to start by first, what put the idea of writing a novel into your head? Like what triggered that?
Man, sorry, I was gonna say it's like an unwanted pregnancy. Like when the thing just happens, you know, when you just find yourself with child all of a sudden, the child just has to come out. I've been writing poetry, writing plays since I was, I don't know, like secondary school. You know how we used to do all those plays for parents. So my first play that I wrote, I think I was in Jess's 2 or Jess 3. And the first poem that I wrote, I also think I was in probably, it's actually a very, very, very funny story. So there's this girl that I had a big crush on in secondary school.
That's how it usually starts.
Yeah, and I just didn't know how to go about it. So that summer when we went home for vacation, my cousin, who is this super cool guy, still is like the Puff Daddy of Africa, he had this book of poetry that he wrote. So I like to think that I borrowed it. I think you have other opinions. I borrowed the book and I took it back to boarding school. And I was basically showing everybody in the school, like, yo, this is my poems. And the girl, obviously, that I had a big crush on started to look at me nice because she thought that I wrote poetry. And then I became so, like, everybody was just disturbing me for the poems. And then my teacher got a hang of the whole ruckus that I was causing. And then she seized the book from me.
Oh, no.
And I was like, yo, I need poems. So I just started writing poetry from there. And then when I came to Canada, I joined a poetry group and then we started building much more. So I've always been writing poetry, been writing like long form essays, plays. And I think I had gotten to a point where the poetry was no longer enough to say the things that I wanted to say. And the plays were just not the right format to say the things that I wanted to say. And I'd written this article for The Cable Nigeria. It's a popular online newspaper. And it was called The Times I Died and While I'm Still Alive. And it was an essay about literally I had died almost 7 times before I turned 7.
What? So wait. Is that a real life story? Or was that like... Oh, interesting.
Hit by a car, hit by Okada. Those
hit by a car?
I thought you were about to say like a medical thing. Hit by a car?
Hit by a car, hit by Okada. the funniest one was actually...
Funny.
Yeah, it's actually so funny. When I tell you this, you like you should have gone. I was like 6 or 7 in primary school. And you don't remember those water bottles that are like big and orange or big and green?
Oh, no, I know what you're talking about. The ones that when you unscrew them, you can drink from the...
Exactly, with the white
from
cork.
From the cover.
Oh, yes.
Exactly. Yes. So I swung it over my neck and I was playing on the jungle bars in the school. And somehow as I was swinging from one jungle bar to the next, the bottle got caught on one of the bars. And I was literally hanging my neck on the jungle bars. And
there's the only one laughing at this?
And there's a bunch I nearly drowned. Then one of the most telling experiences of my childhood was the Ikeja Cantonment bombing. I don't know if you guys remember that.
Oh my gosh, you know what is so crazy? Sorry to interrupt you, but I was literally talking to a friend about this exact thing like 2 days ago. And she was saying how she couldn't remember it. Like, and I was
there was a bombing.
I remember this thing so vividly.
Yeah,
it wasn't a bombing, but more so, Mama, do you want to tell the story?
An explosion.
It was an explosion. So I think they had a bunch of explosives and it wasn't like stored or kept properly. And then it went off. And this happened, I believe, in 2000 and 2002. Yeah, so like it went off and it was like it literally like shook. I would say it like shook Lagos because
yeah, it felt like we were under attack.
Exactly. I literally felt my house shake.
Yeah.
No way.
And yeah. But that's the story.
And my
I'm so sorry, Chuki. Do you know why we don't know it? We were in Port Harcourt.
And we're young too, like probably.
Yeah, we weren't watching the news, so we weren't there. Yeah.
So my family lived in Ikeja, the like larger Ikeja area, but we didn't live like right close at the core. Barracks. So we felt everything in a very intense way, but we just felt the aftershocks. We didn't see any of the like the major loss because so many hundreds or thousands, if not thousands of people lost their lives. Mm-hmm. I remember we didn't go to school for like a week or 2 weeks, maybe 3 weeks after.
Yeah, it was pretty bad. Some of my aunties had to jump into the canal. And there's some people that jumped into the canal drowned. It was
no
crazy.
Way.
Yeah, so in the essay, I highlight that these are very, well, aside from the cantonment, which is a very, very, very tragic loss, I joke that these are very butty ways to almost die. Because at the end of the day, I lived a relatively peaceful life in as a kind of middle-class family in Lagos. But I started thinking about this character who refuses to die in a place that insisted on killing him, you know? And I thought it just made a very interesting premise for a book. And then as I started thinking about some of my other experiences, I went to Capital Science Academy in Abuja for my...
Oh, you went to Capital Science?
Yeah. I was there for just like one term though.
Oh, sick.
Yeah, but the year before I went to Capital Science, a lot of young folks died in a tragic boat accident. And then obviously later the Loyola plane crash that took the Loyola folks and my family members and other people, of course, were on the Dana plane crash. So I started pulling together all those experiences and then found this really compelling character to tell the story of the precarity of life for a lot of young folks in Nigerians, but I was very focused on kids and on children and the precarity of childhood in this place that we call home. But I wanted to do it in a way that was fun and dynamic, that not just captured how we died, but also captured how we live. And just the boisterous banter of boyhood, the dormitory banter, you know, like that electrifying energy of boyhood. I mean, I'm a boy, so I stayed in the boys' dorm. My secondary school was co-ed, so I had no idea what happened in the girls' dorm. So I kept it as a non-boys school. And then, yeah, that story has been in my spirit for a long time. And I started writing about 3 years ago. And when I knew that I had enough material, I was more than halfway done. Then I knew that I just needed to lock in because I had the 9-to-5, took a bunch of time off, went to Jamaica to write. And I got most of it done in Jamaica. And then when I came back, I was cleaning it up. And then I went to Nigeria to finish the last parts of the book and do a coming of age ceremony.
So I just had a quick question. Why Jamaica?
I was just about to ask that same.
So Jamaica has this literary festival called Calabash. And I've always wanted to go to Calabash. It's like a festival for Black authors from all around the world. From the Caribbean, from the Spanish Caribbean, from the English and French and Creole Caribbean, from across Africa, from Black North America. And I think once every 2 or 3 years, everybody just goes there for like 3 days, 4 days of literary bliss and excitement. And I always wanted to go. Unfortunately, I actually missed the festival itself because it was so popular. All the hotels, all the resorts, everything was booked out because of the festival.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so I said instead of going for the festival, I'll just go to Jamaica and write. Because I was going to stay for the festival, stay in the resort after the festival was done and write. So writing there was always my intention. And I've always known Jamaica as this place with very deep artistic traditions and artistic cultures. So I just felt either which way, I'll go there and it'll be deeply inspiring. And definitely, I got so much good vibes. And there's just peace, tranquility. It was familiar enough, but it was also strange enough that it made me feel safe, but also made me feel like I could explore, you know? Yeah, so that's why I went to Jamaica and it didn't fail me.
Hmm. Oh, okay. Yeah, no, that makes sense. I actually haven't heard of this festival, but I'll look it up. I'm curious about it now.
Yeah, it's called Calabash.
Calabash.
Yeah, Calabash.
Interesting.
Was it specifically, I'm wondering if it was specifically getting away that helped with the writing, or was it specifically something in the Jamaican air? Like, do you think to write a novel, you need to kind of somewhat get away? Because it seems like it's a thing that a lot of writers do, actually.
Yeah, I think it was both. Well, for me specifically, it was both. So there was definitely something about the Jamaican air that, there was one scene that happened in the book that would literally not have happened if I wasn't in Jamaica. Because I think the cool thing about, for me, at least about writing, is the living part. Like we live so we can write. And so looking at the foliage, studying the architecture, like literally looking at the types of trees and the way the trees formed in the mountain and the way the vegetation grows, it struck a couple chords in me. And the heat and the ocean breeze has this very interesting way of mixing that, I don't know, unlock something in the soul. Call me a romantic, but I was literally waking up in the morning, going to the beach, writing for like 4 or 5 hours, going into town, taking a walk or hanging out with a couple of friends, coming back in the night and writing for another 4 or 5 hours. So there was something about the energy, the rhythms, the people, that like the whole place is so musical. And there's obviously really tough things happening in Kingston and Orocabesa where I was. Poverty, displacement, gentrification. It's not poetry, but just being in a place that is filled with so much life and musicality definitely was able to unlock a deeper level of just thought and emotion in me. I went to the Marley Museum, toured the Bob Marley Museum and his old house. I had friends who went to McMaster as well, who were also in Jamaica. I knew they were going to be in Jamaica at the time. So I reconnected with my friend, a friend of mine who was out on, she was only a Mac for like 1 month, but okay. She was on exchange. So she came to McMaster for 1 month and then she went back to Jamaica.
She's Jamaican.
She's Jamaican, yeah, from the island. So we reconnected. A lot of my friends, like two or three other of my friends, we reconnected as well. So it felt like home, but it was also strange enough that I could just unlock. But also the time to focus, no Wi-Fi, no. I really didn't know what was happening outside my my Airbnb. And I did all this stuff on a budget, by the way. Like, it wasn't like,
That was actually the point I was going to ask about, because yeah. I'm like, hold on, this sounds really expensive.
No, it wasn't. So the place on my left, like where I was staying, I stayed in Airbnb. The guy actually happened to be Canadian as well. The place on my left was a resort. The place on my right was in a resort. So I had a resort ocean. Oh. But I got Airbnb price. and then there was a lovely lady who was outside the Airbnb I was staying in, that because I ran out of cash and the ATM wasn't working. And she was just like, yeah, just come and order food. When you're done, just pay me on credit. So yeah, there's kind people all over the place that really helped me get through. So yeah, and I did everything on a budget. I went June, July, when it was off season. The flight was round trip, I think was less than $400. My Airbnb was also pretty budget. And yeah, when I was in Kingston, I was in a couple more upscale hotels because I wanted to just relax. But yeah, everything was pretty budget. Yeah, budget friendly.
Oh, wow. Matilda, let's do it.
No, I was actually going to say, Chuki, after this call, you tell us how you found those flights.
Because yeah. I actually really want to. I really want something like that.
Yeah,
been searching and I can't find those cheap flights everyone keeps talking about. but I know this is... It might be a weird question because you are an adult and yeah, you're an adult and it seems weird, but me, I know that if I was to say I just want to take some time off work and go to like a place that my parents don't understand, them being Nigerian, they would have like fears and be like, oh, are you sure that's what you want to do? Were your parents fully on board with the idea?
Yeah, it's not just that I'm an adult as well, but it's like I'm a 6'3", 300-pound man. So it's different when guys do it and girls do it and kind of the relationships we have with our parents because of our genders.
Yeah.
But I learned a while back, especially with my writing, to not just stop seeking my parents' permission or validation, but to stop seeking anybody's permission or validation, right? So I decided of the thing that I was going to do and I just did it. I don't even think I told them I was going until I was there. and even when I was there, I have one of my adopted moms from Brampton. She's Jamaican. So I let her know that I was going. I let her family know that I was coming. So I had contacts there if I needed help there. I knew that I had people there. But yeah, I mean, with some of these things that we do, even if it's the podcast you're doing, or folks who are writing, or folks who are artists, Well, first of all, you have to know that you're good. If you're just doing, I love your vibes, I have no like no toleration for mediocre art.
Don't just go and do this when you're going to do rubbish show.
Yeah, but if you trust yourself, if you trust your work, if you know that you're actually doing this thing because you love it and you're not doing it to play, then man, God has given you the mandate. So it's just about you going to do it. And when the product is done, your parents will be the first people to come and clap for you now.
Pastor.
Yeah, so I stopped seeking anybody's permission and anybody's validation for the stuff that I'm doing. And I know that the work that I'm building, I'm trying to build into the, bring into the world, is going to really impact people's lives, God willing. So there really isn't any time for anybody, whoever it is, whether it's family or not family, to manage my light, because they'll do it out of love. But yeah, they would like dim your lights because of fear, and I have no time for that.
Yeah, I think my mom would hop on a plane and find me where I am. I am not even kidding.
Really?
Yeah, but that's another conversation. Hadiza, did you have a question?
Okay, yeah. So what is, I guess, your experience in Jamaica? What was the most profound? I don't know how to frame this question. Maybe there are more two questions in one. Like, did you have any life-changing kind of experiences there, or something that you were like, wow, this is a completely different frame of thinking or your perspective?
There was nothing that was so profound and transformational, but there were a lot of beautiful moments. So I'm a big reggae fan, a big reggae fan, not just like Bob Marley and the Marleys, but I love the new stuff. I love Chronics, love Prodigy, love Ziggy, Kabaka Pyramid. So driving from Kingston to Orcabessa, which is where I was staying, and the driver just pointing out, yo, that's the road to Spanish Town. I'm like, yo, that's where Chronics is from. That's the name of David Marley's house. You know, those moments. Those moments were really, really just, I was just being such a fan. And obviously going to the Marley Mansion, his Marley Museum was such a, because I love Bob Marley's music. And we went into the room he lived in. We went into like the back of the house where he was shot. So we saw that.
Wait, is it how he died?
No, he died much. I think he died of cancer.
It was cancer, yeah.
Well, that's
we saw the holes. Did you ever go to the museum in Lagos where there's this car that
Murtala Mohammed?
Yeah.
So we literally put our hands in the holes in the wall where the bullets tried to hit him, and we forget sometimes that these people are human beings.
Yeah.
And just to see how big and vast a human's life can be, you know? It was just so incredible. And then there was some other thoughts. And so we went to a lot of, me and my friends went to the local art shows, the local poetry shows, and the quality of art was really, really good. It was very, very high. And I got to perform as well on some of the stages as well.
Oh, that's exciting.
Yeah, there was open mic, so I just went and I started spinning. So it was very cool. And hey. And there was one other thing. Yeah,
that's actually my bucket list.
Oh, that's good. Really? So the thing that actually really changed me and really influenced the book was literally the foliage. Jamaica has such beautiful vegetation. The palm in the mountains, the flowers in the mountains, the shape of the mountains. And this sounds very maybe odd and specific, but if there's anything that really changed me on how a place could be, and the Imamai might appreciate this, but even like Orcabessa where I was looked like Owerri. It looked like Owerri. So it was so interesting to me how somewhere could be so strange and so familiar at the same time. So I didn't have any like big transformational moments, and I don't really think that I was going looking for those. You know, just those moments of humanity that just have a way of piercing through you.
Yeah,
right. Cool.
Sorry, can I just say that the way he even said that sounded so artistic, like just those moments of humanity to find a way of piercing through you. I love it.
Yeah, I feel like generally the way that you talk, Chucky, paints a very good picture, but I think it's the writer in you. Like I literally am picturing it in my head, at least my picture anyways, probably not exactly.
Hopefully somebody buys my book, but I appreciate it.
yeah, but we're helping you sell it. We're saying that this is just a sneak peek into what you could get from the book. Exactly. And this is him just talking, though. So you can imagine.
Imagine like when he has spent time,
you know. Would you encourage more people to do stuff like that? Are there any pitfalls to taking that much time off work and like coming back? Was it transformative? Would you advise more people to do that? Because it's something I've always wanted to do, but I just don't know how and where in my career it fits in.
Everybody has it. I don't like giving people advice, but everybody has a different calling. And I think I think I'm only really interested in people who are convicted by the calling. And I know that if you don't follow that calling, you just go mad. So my advice, if I can even give advice, is if you know you have that deep conviction, just put it in your plans, you know, like find time for it in your schedule, or else the thing would, it'll either drive you mad, or it'll just walk away and go to the next person who's ready for it. Because there are some people that their chi or their god or whatever has called them to do something beyond just clock in and clock out. And if you know that is you in your spirit, then stop wasting your time, you know. And you have to plan for it. You have to budget for it. Because I have other responsibilities, not just with work, but with family and with other life responsibilities. And you cannot let those responsibilities fall by the wayside, because at the end of the day, you live in the world and the world is material.
Yeah.
So this Jamaica trip, I planned it almost 6-7 months in advance. First of all, I had the intention for about 4 years. Mm-hmm. And then once I had the finance, I mean, COVID happened, so I didn't go. Then I had to plan again. And then I got my financing in order. Like, it's something that I sat down and planned for. So you have to give your dream space to breathe, you know? It'll either choke you or leave you. So and some people are fine with both and some people are not. So, and I haven't even found the perfect balance in my life. I'm still constantly negotiating. But at a point, and I think I'm at that point now. I've actually crossed that point where I have my primary responsibilities to my family, at least the immediate ones, I have met. So now I'm in a season where I'm saying, okay, what are my primary responsibilities to myself? And those responsibilities include getting my book on shelves, teaching, talking, being in classrooms, being in community centers. I want to be able to touch and teach across the African continent in classes, poetry, creative writing, just give young Africans tools to access their joy and their strength and their power. And I haven't seen a job description that says that. So I'm kind of creating my own thing by myself. Yeah, and it'll be hard. And there's a lot of things that I know that I will not have because of that. But I also know that when God has given you a conviction, he will also make a way for you, right? So I'm just trusting that that is the process. And I know to hold you. I know to hold you like that.
Amen, Brother Chuki.
I know to hold you, but you know, there's some fundamentals, you know, like if God has given you a gift, he has also prepared the path for you. So I don't need to pray like that. I just know that that is already guaranteed. So I'm just walking, knowing that the path has already been prepared for me. I just have to walk it well.
Facts.
Word.
Okay, let's journey with you now to Nigeria. Did you come back to Canada before you went back to Nigeria, or did you just go straight from there to Nigeria?
Well, so I wrote a chunk of the book in Jamaica. So then I went to Nigeria in early December. Mid-December. And then I went down for my my coming of age ceremony, which I guess is the big, actually, what this part is about.
And that's 2023, right?
23, yes.
Okay.
Yes. And that's when, so that's actually when I did the first series of rites for my Iwakwa. Iwakwa is the wearing of cloth, the coming of age ceremony.
I've been waiting for you to pronounce it.
I was like, is aqua like cloth? Like, you know the way there's like aqua, chat, that kind of thing.
Yeah, aqua, yeah. And iwa is to wear.
Okay. To wear.
Yeah, so Jamaica, no, sorry. That was actually my first time doing Dirty December.
So you went to Lagos too. It wasn't just Imo.
Yeah, I went to Lagos. I went to Lagos first, showed them camp.
So how was your Dirty December experience?
It was very dirty. We give thanks. Saw the cavemen show, saw Palm Wine Fest, which I thought was incredible.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. Then saw Chike live, and then saw some plays.
Oh, I love Chike.
So from Lagos, then I went to Imo. and then Owerri from Imo went to Owerri to the village. And so in our culture, in at least not our culture, because that's Igbo people are actually very, very diverse.
Yeah.
But in my village, Umuebubem in Ndiuhu, in Ubo local government, okay. We have this thing called Ibiri. Which
Sorry, Chiki, can I just pause you for a second?
It's a local government thing.
It's so funny, yeah, the local government thing, right? Because like, it's like when you said it felt so natural to me, but I heard Martina laughing. And I can
I'm laughing because I know Igbo people always, when they say where they're from, they always say the local government.
The local government. And it's so funny because I, like when you said it, like it made sense to me, right? And then I kind of knew why Martina was laughing. But then I also remember when like somebody had asked if my village, and I had basically said exactly what you just said, like my village, and then local government. And they were just like, bro, like, why are you telling me your local government. But it's just so funny because I feel like it's a thing that like I'm not even sure why,
yeah.
But I just remember like when I learned to tell people where I was from, I always like, you know, had to add local government. And I even have like a certificate from like my local government that says that this is like I'm actually an indigenous of like, yeah, of this place. So like if you catch me anywhere in the world, I can show you that certificate.
That is cool though. I mean, like if for example there's a war, I keep saying this, you can always go back there and somebody will give you, I don't know, but
you have your certificate.
Actually, you know what? Maybe that's the reason why. Like, I didn't even think about that, but that could be.
Because how would they know who you are, right? You have to show, okay. I mean, they will know probably if you say, this is my father or grandfather or,
right.
I don't know. But the certificate also is like, I mean, I'm a citizen. Give me space.
It's probably connected with how, you know, from the Biafra war, civil war, and just how Igbo people go back and always make sure that no matter what they do, they build a house in their village. Establishing roots and being like, no matter where I go, I am from here.
Even this Dirty December thing, everybody just appropriated Igbo culture. Everybody just going back.
Because I go to my village, like since I was younger, I've been going to my village.
I mean, of course, we go to every village, but it's kind of like, it's like, I mean, you know what we mean, Batuna. Like, it's like,
people go every year. I don't know. That's what I heard, that people go every year.
We go every year.
Like, every Christmas.
But fair enough. Yeah.
But yeah, sorry, Chiki, continue your story.
No, we also have a way of just saying this whole place in Nigeria is just Igbo, Yoruba, and Hausa. So I always give space for the minority of the minorities to hold their own.
I mean,
Adisa, let's go.
I mean,
I said, Adisa, rise up.
The minority of the minorities.
You know? So yes, you just said where you were from and we went on a tangent.
No, it is very cool. So what happens next? So we have this thing called Ibiri. Ibiri is basically your age grade. So if you're born between the age of, within the like 0 to 3, every child born in that bracket belongs to the same age grade.
Okay.
And in our traditional society, in the classical eras, a whole society was basically organized according to age grade. It's like your sets, everybody in GS1, everybody in GS2, and like you do everything together. And eventually you folks become the warriors, the farmers, the governors, you know, and our society is very stratified according to your gender as well or your sex as well. So for the men, it's a very, very important part of organizing society. I mean, if I was born and raised and lived in the village, I would know everybody in my age grade. But obviously because of everybody's not all over the place. So I had to come and meet my age grade. So that was the first step that we did in January of 22. And then they all paid dues. So since they had kind of formalized the age grade, you paid monthly dues, and then they attended events together. So they said, for all the events I have not attended and the dues I have not paid, they gave me, actually, it's a reasonable amount.
It's basically like tax. Okay.
Yeah, it's a tax. And there is, I think it's well within their rights because, yes, they're absolutely correct. So I paid the first set of dues.
Interesting.
So and then they were actually quite graceful. They came to greet me. A couple of them came to greet me, to welcome me, and it was really, really lovely. But it's also that, you know, when you go to the village, at least for me, at least I've known my dad's friends, I've known my mom's friends, I've known my family, obviously, but I had no friends of my own outside who my parents knew. So this was a way for me to connect with those folks specifically and my own peers. So that was that first, the beginning of what would end up being a year-long process. So the Iwakwa is, it's broken down into different phases. There's something called Ishi Imri Iwakwa to cook the Iwakwa meal.
Okay.
So there's three meals you cook. You cook a meal for your age grade, you cook a meal for your immediate family, and then you cook a meal for your extended family.
Okay.
But I was in Canada when all those meals were being prepared. So I sent down the money and my family hosted all those folks on my behalf.
Okay.
Oh, nice. Okay.
And then when the final meal was cooked, then that's when they literally went to write my name in the village registrar, in the village town hall. And they're like, yes, this person is one of us.
Interesting.
Oh, yeah. Interesting.
And technically that is the final right for you to be fully initiated into manhood. But then the parade, which is the celebration of everything, now happened January of this year. Okay. So once I got the dates, I told my boss, I'm like, yo, I'm going
to become a man.
Yeah. She was like, Tricky, what is this? I just like, imagine it's a wedding, but it's not a wedding between you and your spouse. It's a wedding between you and your village. So I explained it to her. And she's like, okay, so everybody in the office is joking that Chucky is going to get married. That's what the joke was.
So before the ceremony, like, you can't be in the village registry, or is it before you do all your, like, is it before the ceremony that you can't be in the village registry, or is it before
once you've cooked the last meal, then they write you into the village registry.
Interesting. Okay.
The celebration is just to commemorate.
Yeah, the commemoration, exactly.
I really am interested in, like, does every Igbo person do this? Because you said there was like a difference specific.
Ask my daddy.
Okay. Yeah.
But actually, no, you know what? Let me let you finish your question first.
Yeah, the insights from your dad would definitely be appreciated. But I was just asking, like, is this a wider Igbo tradition, or is this specifically your village or people from Imo? And then what made you want to do it, or do you have to do it? But yeah, Imama, background. Thank you.
Hello. I mean, I'll just give like literally 2 seconds of like input here. So yeah, like, I did ask my dad about the Iwakwa, and essentially what he had mentioned was, so I asked him if he actually did it, because I was like, you didn't tell me that. I mean, like, you know, growing up, it's like you never mentioned that this was a thing that my brother had to do. I don't know if there's a ceremony for women. I assume that there might be. I'm not sure. But like, I was like, you didn't, like, you know, this was never brought up to my brother, and he's a man. So it was like, you know, what is this about? And when I asked him, essentially what he had mentioned was kind of like what Chiki had mentioned, that it's a ceremony to kind of celebrate the coming of age of like a young man. And he actually didn't do it when he was growing up. And like, I was kind of curious about that. And he had mentioned that apparently only a few communities still perform such ceremonies. And I guess like ours wasn't one of those communities. So I'm from Uzubi, that's our North local government.
And please say your local government again, but did they perform it before? They performed it before and they stopped?
So, yeah. So, I mean, like, well, I actually didn't. I should probably ask them that. But when he did say still perform, I kind of understood that, the impression that, yeah, they used to perform it and they don't perform it anymore. Like, that's the way I understood that, because, yeah, he said no, that he didn't do it because only a few communities still perform such ceremonies, such rituals, whatever. So, yeah. But maybe I should ask him a bit more. Remember,
what local government?
Law. I'm from Uzubi, Idiato North local government.
Idiato North, let's go.
But yeah, Obuduku, just
let's go.
But yeah, so he didn't do it. And Chiki, you can go ahead to maybe give us a little bit more insight on your life.
So yeah, Igbos are so diverse. I mean, imagine, I think we're 20 million people or more, right? So that's the size of many countries. So my mother is from Ebonyi. They don't do it in Ebonyi. I have family that's from Anambra. They don't do it in Anambra. But in Anambra, they have, what I've been informed is they have Mao festivals. So they call them masquerades. I like to call them dancing spirits. So you are initiated into the cult of the dancing spirits, and that is their initiation into manhood. So not Iwakwa.
Okay.
And even in Imo, I mean, like in the East, right? There's Imo, Abia, Enugu, Ebonyi. What are the states? You know, it's like, it's a very, very, and we're a very diverse place. And then there's also Igbos in Port Harcourt and Cross River and even Cameroon, like some of the bordering countries in Cameroon. So not everybody does it, which is one. But in Imo, not everybody does it in Imo as well. So I think there are a couple core villages in Imo State that actually still do it. And I don't know all the villages, but mine obviously, Umebubem, is one of the villages. And in Amuzi, in Mbano, because I had a friend whose cousin was from Mbano, and he came back for his Oniwakwa from the States. Yeah, so there are some core local governments, and in those local governments, some core villages, in those local governments that still do it. Why some people do it, why others don't, I really don't know. But I went to my first Iwakwa when I was probably 6 or 7, seeing my one of my uncles going to the market and coming back, and it was like a spell. Once I saw it, I was just like, yeah, I'm going to. Definitely it was just so obvious to me that, not just that I was going to do it, it's just like, oh, when is my turn? And when is it my turn, you know? Because it was like breathing. My uncle Soko, if I remember this correctly, and maybe I'm remembering wrong, but I think I'm correct. My uncle Soko died, and they still did it for him after he died.
Oh,
yeah.
How does that work? Why?
Well, because it's integral to who we are. But also, Igbo people will do many things in your absence. Igbo people will marry you in your absence. Igbo people will name your child in your absence. They would sell you, give you a bride price in your absence. So there's a lot of things Igbo people will do in your absence. But I think the idea is the individual is not just individual. The individual is their family. If you're even this thing, like we have this thing where somebody stands in for somebody else. Right. So some of the weddings I've gone to, say it's a wedding in Texas, your father can't make the wedding because he's in Nigeria. So the eldest uncle will now come in and stand in on behalf of the father and perform all the rites that the father would have performed. So I think that the idea that the family is the core part of the society and the people within the family are interchangeable, I think in my mind, how I understand it to be. So although my uncle was dead, the family was there, right? So people were standing for him. They carried his picture when they were going to the market. And it happened, I think I've seen it happen once or twice where somebody died and they carried their picture, or somebody was not able to make it to the village or for whatever reason. So they carried their picture to parade.
They carry a picture.
Oh no, I was there, right? So I was
for the cooking part.
Yeah, for the cooking part, they just zoomed me in.
Fair enough.
Yeah, yeah. So
I was
in the office. It was the office in Hamilton here, and they just zoomed me. So I was just hanging out with them.
Did you order food, like traditional Igbo food? I had
jollof rice and chicken.
Oh, okay.
What food did they cook on your behalf?
It's usually the traditional Igbo food. So there's always yam, roasted yam, and hot pepper. Mm-hmm. There's always abacha. I'm so embarrassed, I've forgotten the name. Abacha is when it's white, but when they cook it, it's something else. It's like jollof abacha. People are going to kill me your DMs, but you know what I mean. we fry a lot of goat meat, cow meat, obviously chicken. We're actually not really big on the like jollof rice and fried rice and all that stuff.
Barely anyone actually is. I don't even know what jollof rice is native to, apart from like Senegalese people. It's not really a native.
I think jollof rice is like what boga is here. Yeah. It's just, or pizza, I feel, is what jollof rice is to Nigeria.
But some people say pizza is like Italian, right? So,
To Americans, not like Italian.
Okay, to Americans,
what pizza is to Americans.
Generic stuff, yeah.
Yeah, jollof rice is like basic.
Yeah. Yeah, so with the abacha, you can make it, you can eat it like as a regular kind of cassava flakes, or you can cook it and then it becomes abacha. So those are, and the akara, obviously, and then there's obviously palm wine is flowing.
That's cool.
Yeah, freshly tapped palm wine. Yeah, so those are basically the staples, at least what was served at my coming of age and what I grew up around.
I saw that it seemed like when they do the ceremony, there's other people there. What ages do... Like if you grew up in the village, for example, what age would you actually be doing that ceremony? Because it's a coming of age. So I imagine
it's around 25 to 30.
Okay.
Yeah. So there's, I think all of us are within, so I'm 28. So a lot of us were within that general age bracket.
Age range.
Okay. Yeah. So we leave it till quite later in life. Because a lot of other coming of age ceremonies happen much younger.
Yeah.
Like right at 25?
No, much younger. Like if you think about the Jewish bar mitzvah.
Or the kissing era.
Oh, okay. I see. You mean yeah, of other cultures.
Yeah, you do it like 13, 14, 15. And ours is like 25 to 30, basically.
Yeah, like TikTok, your brain has formed. Sorry.
Scream.
I mean, it makes sense.
Prefrontal cortex.
Before then, you didn't really have enough sense to actually become a man.
Facts. Do you think it's always been that? Or before, do you know if it was performed before that age?
I have no idea.
Okay.
And I also learned that it also hasn't always been a thing. So I understand that it was created in the 1950s.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so it's not one of these traditions that are like super, super old, you know?
But you know what? I actually love that because I feel like things like that just always remind us that traditions can evolve and change and be
and
added.
Culture, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. It's like you do not have to be so stagnant and stuck. But that's
question,
great.
Do you know the origin story for its origination?
No,
like,
I don't.
Okay.
Interesting. I don't know.
Because that is pretty random. Like, why did they just decide, we want all men to now start?
It's a bit self-indulgent. Come on, guys. Should they have other things to do?
When I think of it, I think, I don't know if the age grade, why can I speak? It's been a long day, sorry. But the age grade thing, has that always been a thing?
Yes.
Okay. I understand the need for that. I don't know about
the age grade. Yeah. Is so integral to who we are as Igbo people. Mm-hmm. That is how we were organized from maybe that's our social organization, a cultural organization, a political organization, our war, our farming, everything is tied into that age grade network. There's a whole schools, roads, hospitals that are just built by age grades.
Okay. So your age grade, is that gender specific or is it men. Like, you know, literally everything? Okay.
Just men, yeah.
Do women have their own age grade?
I don't know.
Come on, dog.
I think the answer is no. My best guess is no because our tradition is the women marry out, right? So we had this like cultural festival where all the age grades paraded. But the women didn't parade, but it was the men and their wives who paraded.
Right? Interesting.
So women from other villages marry in, and women from our village marry out. Right? I think is how kind of the Igbo.
So you get to participate wherever you marry into.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. Aww. Okay.
You sound so sad.
Poor girls.
And I won't be able to speak to the initiation rituals of women because all of these things are guarded and not even guarded, but they're socialized in the context of womanhood. So as a man, you won't even know when it's happening because your mind is just with your uncles or your sisters with her aunties and you don't even know
what's going on there. Yeah,
exactly.
But I can see it being super cool to know literally everyone in the village that is your age.
Yes.
That just is so cool.
And then when you're thinking about it from kind of this diaspora context, my neighbor in the village lives in New Jersey, right? Like, so now actually when I go to New Jersey, the guys might, I have a connect in New Jersey.
Yeah.
Right? Like when I go to Owerri, I have another connect in Owerri. And then we come to the village and then we feast together. But with this, we're actually talking about vast diaspora networks in addition to local specific village networks as well.
Wow. I'm just thinking about where all these things could be really important in our current situation in like the diaspora, where I feel like I'm not so super connected to anything. So I can see that being a way of being connected back to home.
Yeah. There was this guy, my name is Chuki, but my full name is Chukwuebuka. His name is also Chukwuebuka. And we were basically raised as kids together. My dad and his dad were best friends. Well, not best friends, but they were very, very close. And we did that Iwakwa together. Like, we were in the same age grade.
Aww.
Right. So that just deepens our relationship even more, you know? And I hadn't seen him for maybe 10 years. And then we're all coming like, yo, you're in Texas? What? I was in Texas last month. I didn't know you were there. Next time I'm coming, when you're in Canada, you have a place to stay. These are very practical things.
Oh, that's nice. But how was the general experience? So like, how was it like going home and then just like getting to experience the celebrations about like, you know, you becoming a man? How did that, like, maybe just how did that feel? Like, how did the day go? And like, just how did everything unfold?
I feel like, I need a therapist to unpack this, man. Cause in like the best, the best way possible, because it was such a dream. First off, if I start crying, just keep rolling tape. I didn't know, like, I didn't know how, I mean, I knew how much it meant to me, right? And you asked earlier on, Matilda, about why I did it. Because it's culture and there's all these things that are obviously fantastic and very important to me and basically form the basis of my, like, imagination and my art and my creativity and all these things. But there's also really personal stakes. So I think I talked about my cousin and my auntie who died in the Dana plane crash.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And then we lost my grandfather. So basically in our compound, we had buried so many people. And, you know, there hasn't been like a celebration in the house for a very long time, you know. Mm-hmm. And I'm the first grandchild in our lineage to do it. So it was basically like ushering in a new generation, ushering in a new era, like opening our gates up to joy, opening up our gates to happiness. And as the first son, as the upper of the house, you know, these are very important things. Not just as the first son, but just as a member of the family, how dare you not try and bring joy to your family, you know?
Yeah.
So it was very important for me to be that vessel of joy, of celebration, of renewal, of rejuvenation, and just welcoming in a new season of love and just laughter in the house, you know? Mm-hmm. And because Liwakwa brings everybody back together. I mean, I had family who were not able to make it because they're in the UK. Everyone, my siblings were not able to make it because the tickets were too expensive.
Thanks.
But my cousins who were there came, some of my aunties from Enugu came, and then folks who were not able to come physically, they'll send money, or, you know, people are praying for you, you know, just like everybody's attention is on joy and it sends out that vibration and that, you know, those prayers out. So, yeah, so going into the festival, I kind of had the burden of that responsibility on my shoulders.
Mm-hmm.
And but I also told myself, because I know I do this a lot, sometimes I just think in poetry and metaphor. And I said, no, Tricky, you're going to enjoy yourself.
Yeah, ground yourself in that moment and not think higher.
Exactly. Nothing else matters. Nothing else is important. And I also really don't like being the center of attention. So it was really weird for me. Like, you're the celebrant, right? Like, everybody is catering to your every need. So this, funny enough, one of the things that I made sure to do is I always wash my plates. I know this sounds so weird. You know how, life is in the village.
No, but just like something small.
Yeah, just something very grounding. All the extra attention was just a bit uncomfortable, but that's beside the point. So my other problem was that this is a festival of dancing and I cannot dance.
Wait, so you didn't do traditional dancing in secondary school or primary school?
No, I didn't.
Mama, how many people did traditional dancing?
Why are you making it like a subject?
Mama, you were part of the literal Igbo dancers.
Like, you know what is so funny? Literally since primary school. No, since like primary school, like elementary school, I have been part of like a dance group like in school. So to me, it's like, doesn't anybody do traditional dance? Like, isn't this normal? Like, can't you guys, you know, do the whole thing and go to the floor and go back and come back up? But you know what? I guess people are just nuts.
No. So my uncle put me on a 3-day dancing regiment.
I love it.
Yeah. So in the morning, where we come like in the afternoon, and then we were literally playing this, how much is money?
The flavor song.
Flavor song. Yeah. The big ballers in town. So we were like every day in the evening, we'll actually practice the general movement and the steps and just finding the rhythm. So mind you, right, the parade is like a 3-hour parade.
Oh, man.
Right. So it's not just about the dance steps, but it's about the stamina.
Mm.
Right. So, and everybody was looking at me like, yo, you're a big guy. How are you going to do this? They didn't know that I've been planning for almost a year.
For 3 days, you've been put on a dancing regiment.
So they were teaching, but my cardio was very good.
Okay.
Yeah. I've been doing high intensive training. I've been doing boxing. So my cardio levels were very high. I told my boxing trainer that, yo, I'm going for this festival. I need you to destroy me. So when I go to the festival,
wow. I would not be ridiculed in the village.
Yeah, yeah. I can't go and embarrass myself. So for 3-4 months, really high intense cardio, high intense boxing. So, but everybody was looking like, yo, how are you going to do it? But I'm like, no, I can hold my own.
So you don't know about it. So
they don't know about it, but I needed the dance steps. So my uncle taught me those steps. I'm going to be a bit dramatic, but this is real. So the first day we did the dance training, my uncle gave me literally a bed sheet to tie around my waist because to represent the rapper, he just wanted to let me know what it felt like. And then the second day we did the training, we got another rapper, like a real rapper this time, not a bed sheet.
Okay.
You wear two rappers at the market. So I wore the rapper that wasn't going to be my primary colors. I wore like my secondary rapper to give me the weight and the feel. And then my grandfather was, my mom's father was an Omezoe in Afibo, like the highest title anybody can receive. And as part of that, he had this traditional rope that he ties around his waist. My mom's brother gave me my grandfather's rope because my grandfather's eldest son, the rope passed to him, and then he loaned it to me for the festival. And my grandfather was an amazing dancer. Amazing, amazing, like Ogaraya, swag, everything, just on 1,000. But once I put that rope around my waist, man,
the energy entered, man. I love it.
Entered so much. I was feeling it, feeling the movement. You know, I just, everything just locked in.
The ancestors.
Ancestors arrived. I was joking with my dad. I was like, that's why we have two sets of ancestors. Because my dad's father was a terrible dancer.
Okay.
My mom's father was also, he was the one that followed me to the market. So the next morning was the eve of the Iwakwa. Obviously, the women are cooking. So then my mom, as the first wife, organized all my aunties, my cousins. So all the women in the house were on deck. But one of my grandfather's sisters is an expert akara fryer. So she came down from Owerri, prepared all the akara for us. I mean, you know, in these things, the burden of the work actually falls to the women. So I say that not to be sexist, really, but really to honor the work that they were doing and to identify who was actually doing a lot of the heavy lifting on the day of.
Mm-hmm.
Also, in the middle of everything, so you remember those, my age grades that came to meet me the last year?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They now came back to greet me and welcome me back to the village. So it was really nice.
Oh, yeah. That's nice.
Hosted them. We just poured drinks for them. We all hung out. And in the beginning, you know, it's like, it's still awkward because, you know, you're like, we're meant to be friends, but we don't know each other really. So we were just getting to know each other, right? Just talking. Some Igbo was flowing. Some people are not good with English. Some people are not good with Igbo. So we were just speaking what we knew.
Mm-hmm. Wait, sorry, quick question. Can you speak Igbo, Chiki?
On an ordinary day in Canada, I struggle. But when I was there, when you are in the kind of context, it just, the acclimatization helps you. So my Igbo moved from like 20% to like 45%.
Oh, that's significant. Oh,
yeah, that's cool. Yeah. Just being around everybody and just hearing everything, you know, just it flowed much better.
Mm-hmm.
And I can understand almost like 70%. But the speaking.
Oh, okay, no, that's pretty good.
And then the next morning, so the eve of the morning, they called all of us. So the people who did the Iwakwa the year before are meant to be the ones to prepare us and escort us to the market. And then the people who are going to do it the year after are meant to go ahead to the market and prepare the market for us.
Like a way of carrying on.
Yeah. So if you did it before, you're literally going from house to house, getting the celebrants out, tying their wrapper. And then the people who are coming the year after, the next 3 years, that's my brother's set. They literally went to the market, made sure the market was clean, organized the pathway that we were going to walk in. There's this path. They had to put bamboo sticks all over it so that the celebrants knew where they were going. So it was a lot of work being done. The morning of the eve, they called us to the town hall. And the people who did it the year before, they told us how the day was going to go, told us what to prepare, told us what to wear, what not to wear. And then they now said that we have to settle them.
Is that part of the culture is that Nigerian nature?
Yeah. So that's part of this. I think it's part of the culture. So they settle the people before them.
Okay.
And those people settle the people before them. So, but they're actually doing work. Like they're actually doing work. They've been preparing for months and months and months to make sure that we're ready and the village is ready for us. So they gave us a price. We negotiated the price down. And then the head of the age grade had to go to all the houses of all the boys and ask for their own cut. So I think we're 24. So they gave us a price. Mm-hmm. We divided it by 24 and everybody pitched in. And some people could pitch in more and people pitched in and some people couldn't pitch in as much. So we kind of just balanced everything out eventually. Mm-hmm. And I have to go back. So the other interesting thing was the Iwakwa was on a Sunday. So that means we couldn't go to mass. We couldn't go to church because my family's Catholic. Mm-hmm. So we went to mass on the Friday. Mass, for people who don't know, is the Catholic service.
Yeah.
We went on the Friday and the Reverend Father asked all of us to bring our rapiers, bring our swords, bring our whistles, and then he blessed all of it. And there's
I do wonder, are there people that like have a perception that it's a pagan celebration?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are. And I think that's fine. Just don't do it now. Just don't like interfere with the people who are doing it. And if you don't want to opt out, okay. You opt out. But in our village, at least from what I know, it's just like breathing. It's part of the everyday culture. And when I'll get to the end and I'll tell you about just some of the like, kind of conflicting narratives around the Iwakwa.
Okay.
And I will actually share the, when the Reverend Father started praying, he gave this beautiful prayer. He also did his own Iwakwa. The Reverend Father had done his Iwakwa when he was younger. Mm. And then as he was praying, and after he finished the prayer, he said everybody should blow their whistle. And in this auditorium, all the whistles just started going off. And it was just a beautiful, like, mosaic of, it was almost like crickets were screaming at the loudest volume. It was so incredible. And you just felt like you were so connected. And all the old women from the village are there. And your aunties are there. And, you know, your peers are there. It was just like a mighty, mighty love, you know. It was really, really so moving. And then the Saturday, guests are strolling in. And your extended family is coming in and leaving. You know, in our community, it's like, somebody can visit you 3 or 4 times in a day and it's not weird at all.
Yeah.
And somebody visits you in the morning, you go and visit them in the afternoon, they come and visit you in the evening, you go and visit them in the night, and it's normal. Mm-hmm. It's very normal. So we did that in the Saturday morning. And then I think in the early afternoon, there's a scene in my book where my main character is driving from Mbise, which is a neighboring local government, to Umuahia, which is in Abia State. But it's like a 40-minute commute. Obo, which is my local government, borders Umuahia and Abia State. Abia borders Imo State.
Okay.
And divided by the Imo River. So there's a scene in my book where my characters are driving from Obo to Umuahia. And I told my dad that I wanted to literally drive down the route my characters were driving through.
On the Saturday?
On the Saturday, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so he took me down. We saw the route. He took me to his childhood home. So we went to Umuahia and came back. And yeah, it was such a, just a love, just connecting with my dad. And, you know, we're about to go into this initiation ceremony or coming of age ceremony and having that one-on-one time with my father and just not really saying much or talking much, but just him pointing out the place he grew up. And he hadn't been there for 10, 15 years. So it was also very nostalgic for him as well. And just seeing him and just being in his presence that way was quite beautiful. And then we came back. And that evening, we started hosting guests. So we had a live band that came out to start playing. And everybody's house who was hosting, they basically had music going and blasting till 11, probably 11:30, 12 in the night. And then that was a Saturday. The Sunday was when the festival started proper. I woke up that Sunday morning and, you know, back to the promise that I made myself, nothing is going to take this day away from me. Nothing was going to piss me off that day, I decided. And I was going to be fully present in the moment. So, and then when we were just waiting because we didn't know when they were going to come to us to get us ready. So I woke up ready. I had my cutlass, I had my whistle, I had my my wrappers. So they take the wrapper you're going to wear and then they hang it in front of your house. So that's almost like the Passover. So when the people are walking past, they don't even celebrate and lives in the house. And when they come in...
Oh, that actually reminds me. I had a question about... Because I watched the video, right? And I just, you know, it just striked me because I haven't been to Nigeria in a while and I haven't been to the village since I was 5 or less. So it just was striking that everything was open. Like, even in the video, you said, you basically give us your house address. That's what it felt like. I was like, are you not scared? That's what I felt when I watched it. And then, so when you said they hang the cloth over so people know this is about to happen. I'm like, can anyone see? And if you were to put your village into context, in terms of square meters, how many square meters would you say your village is, or square kilometers, just to contextualize everything, I guess?
Yeah, I don't think there's more than 2,000 people in the village. Yeah, so I can't give square meters or that, but I don't think there's more than 2,000 people in the village. Maybe like maximum 10, but I think 10 is also quite large. And the families all know each other. We are connected historically. It's and my family is also quite a public family as well, at least in the Imo State village context. And you know, we have no addresses, right? So you just, if you walk up to anybody in the village and say, "I'm looking for so and so," you address people by household. You know, so even it was very funny. So I think the Friday or something, I was just walking in the walking, having an evening stroll, and a woman stopped me and she said, "Look, you look like you have the face of an Ibe." She said,
"I love that though."
And she's like, "Yeah," and I greeted her, and so we just carry on, you know.
But it's not even a thing, because everybody knows. It's not even about address. People just know your house. People know where you are. People know where you're coming from.
They know what piece, what face is connected to what land.
Wow.
It's actually funny.
They don't just know you. They know your family.
Exactly. No, my dad was telling me a story about how, like, you know, growing up, and like he would kind of go back home and stuff like that. And one time he like went back to the village, and I think he had like a medical emergency, and he like fainted. And people were like, "Oh, like, you know, is that the child called his name?" And like, you know, his last name. And they're like, "Oh, that's this person's son." And like, you know, their uncle lives like down the road. And it was just interesting because it's like just based off of his family name, they could literally point to like four different uncles that they could take him to, and like different houses. And I think like things like that are not as common in like the city like nowadays. It's definitely like such like a village thing, where it's like community is like so deeply ingrained, that it's like everything, like everybody knows everybody just based off of a last name, and they can literally trace you back. Like if you come and say your last name, they can tell you who your father is and where your father's father your father's father's land was. And those things are just really interesting.
And so when we were getting ready Sunday morning, they brought out the wrappers from our fence, and I was literally just standing there like an infant, and these men were dressing me up, right? They tied the wrapper around my waist, tied the wrapper around my shoulders. They took this white powder, sprinkled it all over my face. I didn't even know, like, I didn't even know when the thing started and when the thing ended. I felt like I was in a trance. The band was playing at the back, beautiful music. But I need to take a step back. So everything we wear is symbolic. So the aqua of Kri, obviously the wrappers are the ultimate symbol of coming of age, of wearing this new identity as a man. And then my mother picked the colors to identify, symbolize. She picked purple because it symbolized royalty, to identify the lineage we're from. And then we have a sword, a cutlass that we carry, and the cutlass was gifted to me by my father's age grade. And it was a beautiful ceremony that we did when they passed us the cutlass. And everybody should come with a cutlass, period. But instead of buying one, they gifted it to me, because the cutlass symbolizes, as a man, your ability to protect and defend your family. And the whistle they gave us was a whistle to identify when you're in distress and to be able to call for help and seek help.
I love how everything has been in.
Yeah.
I'm practical.
And then the rope that I wore, obviously, had said that my grandfather was an Amazwe, so I wore his rope as well. And then my grandfather from my father's side, he had a fan, a native fan, that I carried to the market.
So it's like embodying the men that came before you, kind of thing.
Exactly. I wear a Nike shirt.
I thought that. I was like, this is
I'm still from the West.
It looked like a Nike commercial, like an Igbo Nike commercial. But the whistle, we have a local whistle, but I chose not to use a local whistle, because in Hamilton, where I live, we make whistles here. The whistle that we make is used in the NBA. It's one of the best.
Wait, is that actually like a thing? Like Hamilton is known for making whistle?
Yeah. We have one company called Fox 40 that makes whistles for the NBA.
And so Canada can be known for be making the most obscure.
So random.
I don't remember what I read, but I was like, Canada, and this item is used so widely, and you're like, oh, okay, this is cool, but also like
weird,
random, like you said.
Was that on purpose, like choosing that whistle?
Yeah, I chose because of Hamilton. Yeah.
Okay.
I'm a Hamilton boy as well. They call me Dogo Hamilton. This is how my father calls me.
Dogo Hamilton, I love it.
So yeah, I took the whistle specifically to, because I mean, if it was any other context, imagine if the two worlds were combined. All my friends from Hamilton would have been invited. Actually invited a lot of people, but I said, don't come because I know the ticket is stupid. But I just invited them just to, out of love. And it's like, I would love you to be there, but I know you can't come. So don't even worry. I apologize.
Aww.
So yeah, so that was just my little representation of my city. The city that raised me, Hamilton.
I know this is really random. I just wanted to say before I forgot, but these coming of age ceremonies, I think they sound so profound, and I feel like a lot of cultures had these things for a reason. And I feel like we've lost it. And now, like, the only thing I can kind of liken this to now is a wedding.
Yeah.
But I feel like there's such a need to have a coming of age ceremony that's decoupled from getting married to someone, because not everyone goes through that, right? And I feel like there's this weird stage between you leaving teenagehood, being an adult, but still not being taken serious by your family. Like, there's still a need for that kind of thing, I feel, and to celebrate your adulthood without it being a marriage thing.
Right.
Do you get what I mean? Yeah. So I just find it very interesting that there's very many parallels I can draw between this and like you being able to invite everyone, connecting to your culture.
Yeah.
Like, I can only find that right now in weddings. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
But yeah.
So this is like the final stage this is the parade itself, mm-hmm. The procession. So there are two markets that are of importance here. The first market is called Obotuku, which is like a stone throw away from my grandfather's compound. It's like a 3-4 minute walk. You barely think when you get there. So there's that parade from our compound to that market. And there's another market. Remember when I said first Iwaku I went to, I was probably 6 or 7. Mm-hmm. That market is where the market that I went to is called Ekala, which is the main market of that services our village and some neighboring villages, a very big market. So my grandfather's compound is the closest compound to that market. So everybody everybody came out from all their nooks and crannies in the village and then stopped in front of my grandfather's compound. And then I was one of the last people to come out. So my village was doing the ceremony, but other villages were also doing the ceremony at the same time. And the way the village is, so my village is called Umu Ebubem. Umu means child of Ebubem. So each of the villages have seniority. They're like siblings. So one sibling is older than the other sibling. So my village is the last born.
Okay.
So we are the last to go to the market. So by the time we were going, some people were coming back.
Interesting. Okay, so everyone has their turn.
Yes, right. So it's not like 100 people going at the same time.
Yeah.
So those people that we settled, they are part of the people organizing the schedule.
Okay.
Right. To make sure that there's a degree of order and sanity to the whole thing. Yeah. So, and even within that village, the families have seniority. So we lined up according to the seniority of our families.
How is that determined?
Yeah, I was just about to say.
Just the way they know which village is older than which village. In the household, they know which family is older than which family. And it was just so common sense to people. Because don't forget, this is a ritual that they have done since the
50s. For many years,
right? So they're like, whose son is this? This is where you should stay. Blah, blah, blah. This is a move, done. And I didn't even know. I just found myself second in front of the line. And I was like, okay. And I looked around.
Your family is second born.
Yeah, I think so. Something like that. Or at least if not second born, but not, so it's not every family that presented somebody.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Right?
So of all the 24 candidates. And seniority is not the matter of status or power or privilege. It's literally just ancestry and lineage.
Yeah. Loki, that, do you feel like that in itself poses some kind of privilege in a sense, like, okay, your family is senior versus your family is junior?
No, I think the other beautiful thing about Igbo culture is our ability to really focus on the strength and the outcome of the individual, right?
And not the, I don't say caste, but how they were.
Yeah, you can. You can. Like, it doesn't matter what family that you were born into, you can rise above that status, right? And by your effort, you can change your situation. Right, that's.
But I mean, technically, in Igbo culture, isn't there osu? Is that what they're called?
Yeah, the osu, the caste system. Yeah,
the caste. There's still that, though, right?
I don't think it's not something that I'm aware of that's practiced in my village.
Okay.
And I know, and I understand, even in a lot of the places that is practiced, that either been legislated out or acculturated out. But there's still a lot of individual families who hold prejudices. But in terms of like systematic disadvantages, maybe it exists and maybe I'm privileged and I'm protected from it.
From knowing that, okay.
But I'm not, like, I haven't really experienced it aside from just daily prejudices. But I'm sure it would have affected people's historical status. But as an Igbo man, an Igbo person, if you are able to, by the force of your own will, rise above your status, that is also very, that's like the point of our whole culture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that does kind of remind me of Things Fall Apart, right? Because it was also something that, like, Chinua Achebe had mentioned in, I'm reading Things Fall Apart for the first time, and it's quite interesting.
Oh.
But that's kind of something that had happened in Things Fall Apart, where, what was his name again? The main character, not Ikemefuna. Yeah, Okonkwo. Yeah, where Okonkwo essentially like rose above like his father's rubbish status based on his own works and everything that he had like kind of acquired to his name.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, I guess that also tracks.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then one of the things that was very beautiful for me as we stood in that line is just how international it was. It was so interesting.
Worldwide.
Yeah, we came to the world. So we obviously had people who lived in the village. We had people who lived in Owerri, lived in Enugu, lived in Lagos. We had people who lived, obviously me, in Canada, folks who were in Baltimore, in New Jersey, in Texas. So, and we all came down to do this thing together. So I think to me, it just spoke volumes about just the power of the culture and the traction. And there are some folks who came from abroad who just stood in line, took the pictures and left. And then there's other folks who went to the market and did the whole thing. And everybody had a different reason for why they choose to participate to the degree that they choose to. And we respect all of that. I'm just identifying just the range of people and options.
Mm-hmm.
So the first parade was from a compound to Obotuku, which is the junior market. Everybody dressing a different color. Everybody has their whistle. Everybody has their wrapper. Everybody has their families parading with them. So for me, traditionally it would be my brother and my cousin who is in the UK who should parade with me because they're the next to go, but they were not around. So my cousins who are parading in 6 years instead of 3 years were the ones who stood in their place.
Mm-hmm.
And then my other uncle who led me to the market. And then my grandfather's sisters all escorted us to the market as well. And the band that we hired was playing with us as well. So it was like carnival. It was like Caribana. You know, people are playing drums, instruments, live instrumentation. People are blowing whistle. It was dusty. It was sandy. It was hot. The walk that was meant to take us about 3 to 4 minutes from our compound to Obotuku took us maybe 25 minutes.
Hmm.
And then when we get to Obotuku, we then met up with other folks coming from other directions. Some people were going, some of us were coming, and then it turned into this kind of big chaotic ruckus of just color and noise and joy and, you know, just noise and Igbo laughter and banter and people shaking each other's hands, giving that 3-3, 1-2-3 and the one chief handshake. And from there, we now broke apart. So Ekala, which is the main market, some people say that place is fetish, that place is, there's a spirit there. You know, there's this like mysticism around the place. So Matilda, you were asking whether it's some people think it's
pagan
and blah, blah, blah. So for those families who didn't want to go to Ekala, they turned back at Obotuku and went back home.
Mm.
But for the people who wanted to continue on, you continue on.
Okay.
Yes. But I mean, remember the cooking has already happened. So all of us are already men. So this is just the parade to put the icing on top of the cake.
Yeah.
But in my mind, there's no Iwakwa that exists without going to Ekala. Cause that's what I saw my uncles doing. That's where I saw my, all my uncles have gone out to Ekala and come back. So it's not even that I'm like, oh, it can't be me that won't do it. We're going to Ekala. Like that's just it. So from our place to the Ekala is maybe another 40, 50 minutes of walking. And the accompaniment was playing with us. And some people were more, because now the procession has broken up. So some people have gone back. There's a lot of space. Before we were packed very tightly, almost like sardines. But now there's a lot of space. You can go fast. You can go slow. You can dance. You can do whatever you want. And then when we get to Ekala, they've put bamboo sticks around the entrance of the market. In the past, only the celebrant was meant to walk through the bamboo sticks. And then there was meant to be a crowd flanking both sides while the celebrant performs like dance and show off as they go to the market. But the culture has since changed. Basically, everybody just went right through the center of the bamboo path. But when we got there, there were these young men who refused to allow us pass. And they said it was that their ancestors are the owner of the market, that they can't let us pass. And then there was a scuffle. Let me put that, say it that way. So my uncles came and they was like, no, we're going to pass. And they said, no, we're not going to pass. And there was back and forth. So we had to forcefully remove them from our path. And then I finished my lap. And then there's people say that the market was cursed, the market was possessed, that there are spirits there. One of the men who was threatening us said, he looked at me and said, anything you see in this place, you are going to accept it because you don't know what's going to happen.
Was there anything there?
I went and came back. Nothing happened to me.
Nothing happened to me.
It was so funny because actually to me, when the scuffle began, when the people came, I was like, oh, is this just part of the show? But like, no, they were actually like, they were for real.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. And so this is we left the house by like 11, maybe got back by about 1:30, I think. People expected me to be tired. My uncle was actually thinking that he thought I would pass out or something during the festival.
I prepared
my body, my mind, prepared everything for it. And then, so the rest of the day, to cut the long story short, was just hosting. So, we're just hosting. The food was flowing. Shire was flowing. Mm-hmm. My mind was flowing.
I love when you say chicken was fluid. Like,
yeah.
I have a question though. Yeah. Like, this definitely sounds like a very interesting and obviously amazing experience. And I can tell how excited you were to just go through everything. And I kind of imagine culture is always really, I think when culture is passed down like that, it's always almost poetic to be a part of something that you have seen. Previous generations do, and uncles and everything. So I'm kind of curious, if you decide to have children and you have a son, is this something that you insist or even suggest that they do? Is this something that you also plan to pass down to your future generation?
That's my son, a bit even odd, but as much as I love culture, you can't force it on anybody.
True.
Nobody told me to do it. I did it because as a kid, I saw it and I saw that it was good. Right. So it'll be up to my child to choose it for themselves. And I will make them aware of the context, prepare them well, give them as much information as they want. But I think the best way to pass on culture is to model it properly. And if your child chooses to accept it, then you've done a good job at modeling it. And sometimes if they don't accept it, it's not necessarily that you've done a bad job. It's just that they don't want to do it. And that's fine.
Very true.
And even the Iwakwa that my grandfather had probably did is probably very different from the Iwakwa that I did. And it becomes something different in 25 years when my child is of age. Right. So, so that's what I think about it. It was funny. My cousins who followed me to the market, they entered the market saying they're never going to do something like this in their life. And they left saying, sign me up.
Oh, that is so nice.
Yeah, fair enough.
At the end of the day, if something is good, people will choose it by themselves.
Yeah, I agree with you. I feel like you painted a very vivid picture. Almost step by step, we were on the parade with you. We were in the parade with you. So I think it was really good. And I think that where you left it at, if it's good, people will continue this tradition and stuff. I hope to see more of things like this, more of people participating in their culture, and like it can mold into whatever it becomes.
Yeah.
Wait, quick question. Mm-hmm. Now that you have been, what I don't want to say, is the word initiated like, or man, like, you know, added, now that you are a man, now that you're part of that club.
You have been acquired.
Does anything change? Like, do you keep in contact with your age group now?
Yeah, we have a WhatsApp chat. And yeah, the individuals that I connected with, well, we've made contact, and there's like real implications, right? So I can and I will pay legal taxes to our local government now. And then
as a man,
yeah. And that's what they did, just take your money for the greater good. And
yeah,
and then marriage, right? So I'm now entitled to marry, right? So if
entitled
so before, I mean, you couldn't marry.
Yeah, meaning if I was married before, it wouldn't have been legal in marriage.
It didn't count. Mm. Okay.
Yeah, it didn't count. So I cannot legally, they say, take a wife. It's such an odd word.
Okay.
But I'm not eligible to
get married.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Wife can take me.
Wife can take her. I love it.
Yeah. So there are real implications, right? So, you can take a title, and basically you can progress through the ranks of society.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. That makes sense.
And Igbo culture is like title, rank, societies, like status. Those are really big things. And to gain access to it is like the bedrock of the framework of, I think, our culture.
Yeah.
Do you have plan to go back to Nigeria again anytime soon?
Actually, so my next book is about... My next book is about elephants. So my priorities for writing and creation are Senegal and Kenya.
Oh,
Kenya. Y'all know how I feel about Kenya. Kenya.
I'll be in Senegal in April, and I'll be in Kenya in, God willing, June, July.
Oh my gosh, pack me in your bag.
I was going to say just that.
Like, let's go, please.
I look forward to hearing even more stories as you travel around the world.
And vlog. And you, if you can. I mean.
Oh, vlog.
Yeah.
I think we're going to consume it all in his writing.
I hope so, yeah. That's right. That's where you find it.
Yeah. Do we know when to expect your book?
Probably late this year, early next year. I'm currently looking for a buyer for the novel, looking for a publisher.
Okay.
So if you know anybody, let me know. If you're a publisher, you can hit me up and we can chat.
Yes, yes.
Excited.
You know, and we're so excited to read the book, to see on the shelves, and to see, you know, more of the work that you do. And you're always welcome here. Like, we always want to tell your stories. We always want to hear your stories. So you know where to come when you've lived all the life that there is to live.
Yo, man, I congratulate the three of you in your consistency. I congratulate the three of you in your excellence. I know there was a hiatus. So I'm very happy that you're back on our back in our airways. I listen to you guys when I'm cleaning. That's usually when my three sisters give me company.
Thank you.
And I'm cleaning the house and just getting in my domestic bag.
Screw.
So that's the context in which I usually enjoy you folks. So really appreciate the work you're doing. The work is consistent. It's excellent. So many people start this thing and then so many people fall off. So. The consistency is I applaud you for it, and the quality keeps getting better, so I applaud you for that as well.
Thank you so much.
The book is ready, I'll come and announce it here.
Of course,
we'll get the first exclusive.
Yes, exclusive.
You said it here first.
You did, yeah. I'll give you the name of the book, but I don't want to before, you know.
Do what
you gotta do.
Yeah. But yeah, thank you so much for joining us today, Chuki. And you guys know where to find us at Afrikalypso Pod on all social media. Tell a friend to tell a friend to tell a friend. Chuki, do you also want to plug Trad?
Yes, yo. So Trad is this thing that it's a not-for-profit, an educational not-for-profit that we run, where we work with young folks to connect with indigenous African ideas. You can find us at Trad_magazine on all the socials. We publish tradmag.ca, and We've currently published two novels through our platform, and we're in the process of writing a third novel with the young kids that we work with. And on the 23rd of March, we're hosting a festival called Write Like. We have the one of the writers from Star Wars coming into town, one of the writers from Black Panther coming into town, and one of the writers from Dungeons and Dragons as well coming into town. Yeah, so that'll be in Hamilton, 23rd of March. So if you're in the area, it's free 99 as well. So you're welcome to pull up and follow us at Trad_magazine. We're social. And if you want to find me, you can also just, I don't have my personal Instagram, so you can DM Trad and I'll find you.
All right. I love how you said you can DM Trad and I'll find you.
Yeah, just if you DM Trad, you're DMing me. So just.
No, I know. Yeah. I get that. I joke. But yeah, thank you so much, Chuki. And I'm looking forward to seeing more from Trad. I love the work you guys do there too. All right, guys. Talk to you guys in 2 weeks. Bye.
Bye.
Have a wonderful week, y'all.